we really want everyone to be able to feel like they have a chance to thrive and grow and prosper, you know, in our community. But it's going to take all of us rolling up our sleeves to help make it happen.
Welcome to Management Matters, a National Academy of Public Administration podcast where policy meets practice. I'm Terry Gurton, president of the Academy. This month, we're focusing on the issue of social equity. In this episode, I'll discuss how mayors consider issues of equity with my guest, Sharon Sales Belton. Sharon is an Academy Fellow, the former mayor of Minneapolis, and she's currently the Vice President of Strategic Partnerships and Alliances at Thomson Reuters. Sharon, thanks so much for joining me today.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here, Terry. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, Sharon, you've had such a fascinating career, and you were the first woman and the first African-American woman mayor of Minneapolis. You served there from 94 to 2001, but that wasn't your first foray into elected politics. So tell us a little bit about what motivated you to get involved in politics and specifically to run for election.
Great question. I spent 18 years in government in the city of Minneapolis. 10 of those as a member of the city council, the last four of the 10 as the council president. And then, as you noted, I ran for a mayor and was elected and just honored to be chosen the first woman to successfully be elected mayor of the city of Minneapolis and the first African-American. Now, why did I decide to get involved in politics? You know, I had a career at the Department of Corrections before I entered politics. I was the assistant director of the Minnesota Program for Victims of Sexual Assault. And I really enjoyed my work working with offenders and as well with victims. And one of the things that I learned in my 10 years at the Department of Corrections is that there are a lot of problems and issues that people experience that could have been addressed differently had there been more effective intervention and in some cases prevention. And I thought long and hard about that and made a conscious decision that I wanted to be a part of an organization that was really focused on helping to find and solve problems. And that's how I got involved in politics. I wanted to move, you know, in a career where I wasn't really dealing with the aftermath of failed policies, but I was in a position where I could craft new policies that could hopefully help us avoid people being victimized and as well people disrupting and ruining their own life because of problems with managing their own behavior.
Well, a lot of times when people are a first of something, they experience some real challenges. The idea that no one like you has ever done this before. Did you experience those sort of challenges either, you know, in the city council or as the mayor?
Well, there's a lot of different challenges that I experienced. Fewer between the office of the mayor and the city council, because I had been on the city council and I understood how the two bodies worked well and where the friction was. So that was less of a problem. Not saying it wasn't a problem. There were definitely issues, right? Anytime you're trying to build consensus to move forward, you know, you're going to have issues that you have to work through. But I understood them. I think the biggest challenges that I faced early on as an elected official, as the mayor of the city, was really people taking me as an individual seriously. Now, why was that a problem? I think it's because a lot of people had not a lot of experience working with women executives. And so people, you know, struggled a little bit with the idea that I'm going to have to take directions, you know, from a woman. And then some of them had problems taking directions from a woman who was also African-American. So I had, you know, a lot of gender and race issues that I had to struggle through to get people to the point that they understood that we're all working for the same goal. And the fact that I'm a woman, the fact that I'm African-American, those are real facts, but they shouldn't be barriers to us moving forward with policies and issues that were really important to the strength and vitality of the city of Minneapolis. So some people just had to get over it.
Were there any particular practices or techniques or catchphrases that you found helpful in overcoming those kinds of misunderstandings?
You know, when I think about that, Terry, one of the first things that really comes to mind was I actually had a group of allies or champions. You know, these are men, and many of them were white men, who just decided that they were going to take responsibility for putting their male colleagues in check. You know, I remember like it was yesterday, some of the conversations that people had with others kind of on my behalf and really helping people to understand that we will not tolerate you disrespecting the mayor of the city of Minneapolis. We're behind, you know, her agenda 100%. And if you're not behind her agenda, then you don't have a place, you know, at the table. And I didn't have to do that. I had some leaders in our community who just weren't willing to tolerate racism, nor were they willing to tolerate sexism. And they called their male colleagues out on that behavior. Now, there were other instances, Terry, where it wasn't so blatant, but it was challenging. And I don't have enough fingers to count the incidences where I walked in the room with a white male counterpart, maybe usually one of my staff people, and maybe the audience didn't necessarily know who was the mayor. They just knew Mayor Melton, and they just assumed that the white man I'm standing next to was the mayor and I was the assistant, right? And so that used to happen all of the time. And it was very frustrating. And it actually just, you know, caused, you know, it made me feel really sad. And it was very hurtful, to be very honest with you, you know, because it was like, how much does it really take for you to find out that the mayor is actually the Black woman, right? I mean, why couldn't you have figured that out? Why do I have to keep experiencing that over and over and over again? And it didn't just happen, you know, when I was out of town. It could happen right here, you know, in my own state. And so that was frustrating. But it was a reflection, you know, of the fact that when people look at leaders, you know, they have this image of who the leader is. And it's not always, you know, the 6 foot, you know, tall white male with pretty blue eyes. It's not always that, right? Sometimes it's a really short, petite woman who's got, you know, a cute hairstyle and she's brown, you know? Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine a lot of our listeners nodding their head with those experiences, just like I was. So thanks for sharing that, because it's so important, as you know, right? You can't be it if you can't see it. And so you carving a path in that position of leadership has surely made it easier for others to follow behind you.
You know, one of the things that I used to say all the time is that I really honor to be the first, but I don't want to be the one and only. Okay. Because if it's all about, you know, just, you know, you breaking a glass ceiling so that you can, you know, crawl through it, that's really not a break. That's a crack. And again, I really want to have, I mean, actually it has been, the legacy has been, you open the door and then a lot of us are crowding through it and moving on to even greater opportunities to be servants for the public.
Well, I want to congratulate you on those accomplishments, but I also want to call particular attention to some of those, because during your time in office, you achieved national recognition as an expert on a whole bunch of things like public-private partnerships and public safety and neighborhood revitalization and economic development. So I want to pick up on those threads with you sort of independently and talk about the role of a mayor in driving that kind of change. So let's start with economic development, because you have a real challenge in Minneapolis with bringing economic development to the community. What tools did you as the mayor use, and were some more effective than others as you went through the process?
You know, this is really a great question, Terry, and it's one that comes up a lot. And it's also hard for some people to, you know, to understand. And I don't mean the colleagues who are listening to our podcast today, but when you try to share this kind of message more broadly in the community, it is sometimes misunderstood. You know, Minneapolis is really blessed to be the economic engine for the state of Minnesota. So a lot of activity happens in the city. We also had a lot of opportunity for more activity because we weren't effectively utilizing some of the resources that we had, you know, in our own backyard. One, namely the Mississippi River that runs through the heart of the Central Business District. Number two, land uses along the river that were a reflection of, you know, the river's importance to the city 70 years ago, 100 years ago. And so lots of policy changes are needed to, you know, to take place so that we could, again, take advantage of the natural, you know, resources that we had and also the strength of our community. Now, to do that, you can't do that, you know, kind of by yourself, right? A lot of people own the land. A lot of people, you know, have a different vision about, you know, how the land should be used. And there are even some people who really, you know, didn't, you know, have a clue at all. Why would I waste time and energy working on, you know, that kind of problem, given all of the complexity of trying to resolve it? Because let's keep in mind, in a central city, a lot of your land is polluted and there's lots of problems and issues that you've got to deal with, right? And mayors, you know, across the country, they all know this, as do the administrators who work with us. But here's the rub. The rub was always that, you know, if you got a good solid plan to grow your downtown and expand your tax base, you've got to be able to leverage the growth in that tax base and get it out to the neighborhoods where, again, nobody is necessarily interested in investing, or the level of investment is so small, it's not enough to, you know, turn around a depressed area. The solutions of the past would be, let's just go in and we'll tear it down and we'll start over from scratch. Well, these are people's lives. These are people's communities. They live there and they just want it to be better. So one of the challenges that we had, or I'll call it an opportunity, was how do we take the strength of the Central Business District and pair that with the neighborhood? So how do we take the growth from downtown and share that growth, you know, with the neighborhoods so that we had access to new resources that we could invest in our neighborhood? That was a very effective strategy for the city of Minneapolis. Now, again, it's not just the city by itself, you know, doing this. We had to work with the legislature because you got to have tools. You got to have financial tools and they have to sign off on the tools. And when they sign off on the tools, that has to mean they've got to win something too, right? They're not going to give you tools in which they don't advantage, you know, them, the state. I don't want to say themselves, but the state. So we had to negotiate all of these things with the Minnesota legislature, with our land use owners in the city, with our neighborhoods, also, you know, with the nonprofit organizations that are also invested in the growth and the well-being of the city and as well its citizens, so that we could have a master plan that everybody would buy into and everybody would support. Now, it takes time to build that kind of collaboration and to sustain that kind of partnership. But in Minneapolis, we did it. We were able to do it. Our program pairing the downtown with the neighborhoods was called the Neighborhood Revitalization Program. People can look it up and read about its history and its impact. We took that same model, Terry, and we applied it to another problem and issue that we had in our city. And this was around our youth. Everybody was talking about what's happening with the youth, problems with gang and violence and school performance and you name it, people, you know, had problems with youth. We took that same model, collaboration, multiple parties, all stakeholders, and came up with a plan. That plan was codified in an organization that we called the Youth Coordinating Board. City, county, state, school board, park board, library board, nonprofit foundations, nonprofit community-based organizations. And we created, again, a national model, a model that we took to the National League of Cities and profiled it there. And we also took it to the U.S. Conference of Mayors to share with them that there was another way that we could work together to benefit our neighborhoods and as well the youth of our city.
So what I hear you saying is that it's not possible for a mayor to tackle these kinds of challenges sort of as their own individual bucket, that you really need a comprehensive approach that shares resources, that gets people involved, that offers the wins that people need to get engaged in the solution development.
Absolutely. And I think the words that I would underscore is shared agenda. This is a shared agenda. You know, when you run for mayor, this is a citywide office, and you've got to talk to a lot of people about where you want the city to go in the future. But one of the things that's really important and critical that people need to understand is that by yourself, as an individual, you can't make it happen. You need partnerships. You need people to be involved. You need stakeholders to step up, you know, to the plate and engage. And engage means bring your ideas, bring your thoughts, but also bring your resources. Because again, if you share in the agenda, if you share the agenda, you have to also have to share in making it happen. And I was fortunate in the city of Minneapolis that I had access to people who were in other leadership roles in other, you know, segments of our society that were willing, you know, to sit down to the table and to create that shared agenda. I think one of the reasons why we're struggling in the city of Minneapolis today is that shared agenda is in doubt. It could have been influenced by COVID. I don't want to sit here and try to say what the reasons are, but when there's not a shared agenda, then I think progress falters.
As you were developing that shared agenda and in these model programs for development and revitalization, how did you include and address issues of equity?
First of all, the issues of equity are just absolutely essential. I think the reason why we needed to create and wanted to create this shared agenda between the Central Business District, our tax base, and, you know, our neighborhoods is because we wanted the people in our neighborhoods to do as well as the people that, as well as our downtown, right? We wanted to share the wealth, share the equity. Why was that important? It's important for a couple of reasons. When we also think about, you know, how do we spend our money? How do we spend the money that we collect from the taxpayers? How much of it is in remediation? How much is it in prevention? How much is in enforcement? And my view was, I got to get out of the, you know, quote unquote, the enforcement business, right? I want to be able to better manage the problems and issues. And that meant that I needed to pay attention to the problems that I had, you know, wherever they were. If that was in my inner city neighborhoods, then I needed to better understand what those problems were and how could I help. I might not be the only person or the organization that can provide the help, but I need to understand what the problem is, and I need to then figure out what are the best resources to marshal. They might not be my own, but I still have the responsibility to address them. So for me, when I was the mayor of the city of Minneapolis, when I was dealing with the neighborhoods in the city that needed the most help, guess what the problems were? The problems were educational attainment. The problems were lack of economic opportunity, no jobs. The issues were health disparities. The issues were housing, you know, lack of adequate housing, lack of safe housing. These were all the problems that I was experiencing. And let me add one more on top of that. The issues were public safety. But I learned, again, because I had a background in corrections, that a lot of my public safety problems were because of the disparities in these other areas, with the housing, with the lack of jobs, with the educational failures. And so it made sense for me, if I was trying to strengthen neighborhoods, that I needed to work on those issues, not alone, but in partnership with others. And guess what? If I did it right, I could drive down the crime rates. I could drive down victimization. There are so many things that I could do if I just thought about this differently and owned up to the fact that maybe it wasn't my primary job to solve that problem, but it was my responsibility to make sure it got addressed.
I know public safety continues to be an ongoing activity for you. In your current role at Thomson Reuters, you're working on long-term answers to issues stemming from George Floyd's death. Why is Thomson Reuters committed to this work?
You know, Thomson Reuters is committed to bringing the tools and the resources that we have at our disposal to the betterment of a government and society. And so, you know, we work on a regular basis with the legal community, the criminal justice community. We work with the public safety community. These are our customers. We work with the tax and accounting world. So these are all our customers. And these activities that they engage in are core, you know, to the stability of any community. And so it just made sense. It was just a natural, you know, for Thomson Reuters to step up to the plate and say, we want to be champions of the rule of law. We want to be champions for access to justice. Whatever that means, we want to advance equal rights. We want to advance the rule of law. We want to ensure that there's equity in the way that we treat people and people are treated by the institutions that we support. So it made sense for us to be there, and I'm honored to be able to lead this work for Thomson Reuters.
Well, they're a local employer there in Minneapolis, right?
Well, yes. You know, for those of us who grew up in Minneapolis, we knew Thomson Reuters as the Old West Publishing Company. And so this is the world's largest provider of legal public records. Now, we have a great legacy. West has a great legacy in Minnesota, and now that legacy is shared by Thomson Reuters.
So as the former mayor of the city and now working with a nonprofit in the space and in the locality, how do you think about philanthropy in addressing issues of race and equity? Is it important to have a philanthropic participant in here to really make progress?
You know, one of the things that kind of is central to the way that we think about a question of this nature is this principle that we have around access to justice. And because that is just so central to the way that we think about our philanthropy, we really find ourselves actively engaged in the reform space. But I want to double back to something that I said a moment ago. We also, because we understand this space, access to justice space, so well, we really understand and know that we need to be partnering with other corporations that are interested in all of the other factors that contribute to access to justice that I talked about a few minutes ago, like housing, like health disparities, like education, like economic development. We don't have to do it all, but we need to be working in partnership with other corporations, with other nonprofit organizations, with the philanthropic community to figure out what is the master plan for Minneapolis, what's the master plan for St. Paul, what's the master plan for the state of Minnesota, and how do we take the lessons that we've learned and share them with our nation? So we really want to do that. We want to be actively involved in sharing information, because when we share information, we grow together. And we don't want to just have a strong Minnesota. We want to have a strong United States of America.
So as you process that work, and as you know, Minneapolis and Thomson Reuters are partners, I know a big portion of your work is focused on police community relations. And it is about police reform, but it's not just about police reform. What are the core parts of the integrated approach that you're looking at to strengthen police community relationships?
Well, I want to first begin by highlighting something that you said, and that is that this is not just a policing problem. This is a societal problem. The issues of systemic racism belong to all of us. We've seen it manifest itself in the actions of an individual police officer in the city of Minneapolis with the murder of George Floyd. But that is, again, symptomatic of other problems and issues that we have in our society. And we also want to spend some time focusing on that. In the short term, we are looking at the issues of police reform with regard to officer safety and also with regard to the safety of the citizens and the respect and the regard that our officers need to have in the relationship that they need to have with the public that they serve. You know, that's on a little, you know, a little bit rocky right now. And so right now we're focusing on issues with regard to use of force, issues with regard to bystander training, and things that we think can help get us back on track. That's what we want to do. We want to rebuild and strengthen the relationship between the public and the law enforcement community. Why? Because we need each other. We need to be able to rely on law enforcement to come and solve the problems and issues that need a law enforcement response. That has to happen in a way that demonstrates and shows respect for, you know, for both parties. The other thing, Terry, that I think we have been able to shed a light on in this discussion, not just in Minneapolis, but across the country, is that we need to move away from this model that every time there's a problem, the police are the right ones to call, because that's just not true. We've been doing that. Every time there's a problem, we think that the solution is to call the police. Okay? It's not warranted. So how do we stop and pause, work on the reforms that we need to work on with the police, but be in other conversations with the human service community about how do we respond to some of these other problems that we've been calling the police for? How about that? Let's do that. Let's change the way that we get problems solved, and let's stop leaving everything to the police. So I'm focusing a lot of my attention right now on, again, helping to build the relationship, rebuild that relationship between the public and the police, and also talking with members of our organization about how do we think differently about how we respond to the human condition.
Sharon, would you say that those kinds of solutions are place dependent? Are they unique to particular places, or are you finding common frameworks that government and community leaders can take up and adapt to local situations?
I'm just going to say to you, it is absolutely the latter. This problem is not unique to any one location. It's not unique to a big city. It's not unique to, you know, the suburbs. This is a universal problem. And it's happening in small towns. It's happening in villages. It's happening everywhere. And this is the time for all of us as appointed and elected leaders, civic leaders, to come together and to help rebuild a new model for service delivery. Let's strengthen our relationships between the public and the police. Let's send the right message to the police about the jobs that we want them to do, and everything that we don't want them to do, or we don't want them to do anymore, let's find a new network of professionals that are better suited to be able to deal with those problems and issues. Not every problem requires us to call someone to show up armed to address the problem and issue. It's just not where we are today, and it's time for us to change.
Well, I know that you are engaged in a program with the National Law Enforcement Museum to tackle this very issue of building a nationwide online community that's going to promote that kind of dialogue and scale new approaches. Tell us about that initiative.
Well, Terry, I'm really excited about this initiative. Soon, the National Law Enforcement Museum and Memorial is going to be launching along with several other organizations, I'm proud to announce. This national app, social media app, it's called Calib. And what we really hope to have happen with the Calib app is that we would be bringing together citizens from all across, you know, the United States, with law enforcement, individuals and organizations from across the United States to share in a dialogue about how do we improve our working relationships? How do we share best practices? How do we share new ideas about what policing can be going forward in America? And I'm really excited about this. And here's what I want to tell you. They started, you know, this idea on a small scale, and the idea took off. And then as the idea took off, more and more people started hearing about it. And then the question came up, can we create an opportunity for all of us or more of us to be a part of the dialogue? And the answer to that was absolutely yes. So we're going to make that happen. Corporations, individuals, nonprofits, all of us have come together to get behind this idea that we're better together. This idea that if we share our ideas and our solutions with one another, we can make improvements that are going to have a lasting, you know, impact for our communities in the area of public safety and well-being. And I don't know about you, but that's music to my heart right now, because it's exactly what we need. More conversation, more dialogue, a shared agenda about what policing in America can look like and what it means to be just a more inclusive community. This is within the range of the possible. And I hope we all take the steps forward that we need to, so this app is successful and that we ultimately are more successful as communities and as people. So quite excited about it, as you can tell.
I love your enthusiasm, and we'll share the link in the podcast notes to the Caleb app so that listeners can find it and join in the conversation. So as we wrap up, Sharon, I know that you've been in the fight for equity and social and racial justice your whole life. What do you see now that gives you hope? And what do you see as the future for Minneapolis specifically?
Well, I think the thing that gives me the most hope right now is that people are paying attention. You know, it's not a small group over here. It's not just, you know, the African-American community. It's not just the community of people on the South Side, you know, who live in the neighborhood, you know, where George Floyd was murdered. It's really a national conversation. And to be very honest with you, it's a global conversation. And I'm excited. I'm excited by that. But now let me move out of the clouds and let me just, you know, bring it home if I could. One of the things that makes me really excited for Minnesota is that right now there's about 80 different corporations across the state of Minnesota who are saying that we are going to be the drivers of making changes with regard to these long-term disparities that have existed in the state of Minnesota. We've been marveling and talking about the problem for 50 years, and we've made little progress. They've launched a group that's called the Minnesota Business Coalition for Racial Equity, and they've taken those five pillars that I mentioned earlier in our conversation today, and they're developing special subcommittees working on each one of these problems and issues. So if the issue is housing and the problem is that African Americans, you know, have the lowest homeownership rate in the entire state of Minnesota, what are we going to do about that? If it's education and children of color have the lowest, you know, high school graduation rate in the country, or second lowest, because we're actually not at the bottom, but we're second lowest. What are we going to do about that? I mean, we're taking these problems and issues that we've known about and we've discussed and we've, you know, made attempts, you know, to look at it, and we're taking a comprehensive approach and we're saying we're all in. That's what has me excited and hopeful. That it's not just one, you know, group saying, I'm going to be the champion for this. But we got 80 corporations saying, I'm going to be the champion. And a growing number of foundations in the state of Minnesota saying, I'm signing up too. And if we can get our entire state focused around dealing with our disparities, I think that bodes well for Minnesota, and certainly for the people who have been experiencing these disparities for so long. We really want everyone to be able to feel like they have a chance to thrive and grow and prosper, you know, in our community. But it's going to take all of us rolling up our sleeves to help make it happen. Minnesota corporations, at least 80 of them are saying, count me in. And I'm actually very excited about that as well.
I love your enthusiasm. I hear you telling me that the time is finally right for change, and change is happening. And so thank you for sharing what's happening on the ground in Minneapolis and Minnesota, for sharing your enthusiasm with us about all the opportunities for progress, and for taking some time today to join the podcast. Really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure to be here, and I hope that everybody listening will sign up for the Calib app.
We'll put it in the notes. Thank you, Sharon.
Thank you. Good to see you.
For our listeners, check back every Monday for a new podcast from the Academy. We'll be talking to Academy fellows each week about the challenges facing public administrators at every level of government as we try to make government work and work for all. Thanks for listening.